My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is a session entitled Noah and the Bomb. I want us to look again at the story of Noah, but this time with an eye to the reality of a nuclear world, and see whether there is there in that story some guidance for us in our own time about the subject of that story, namely God's covenant with creation. The text itself is found in a section of scripture which is often called by scholars in the Old Testament prehistory or primordial history. We should always read the block of materials from Genesis 1 through 11 together. Most often we don't. But it is gathered from the traditions of the Hebrew peoples as a collection of materials. It isn't that the creation is one thing and the curse is another and the Noah account is another. It all belongs together and it should be read that way. And we'll be drawing some lines among those materials, even though we're going to focus in the end on chapter 9. In the prehistory or the primordial history, the figures, the characters, are characters which the Hebrews understood to be represented by us all, or they represent humanity. So you don't think of Adam and Eve or of Cain and Abel as Israelites. Rather, you think of them as human ancestors, the stories of which are also our stories, whether we're Israelites or some belong to some other people. So you ought not to think of Noah or Cain in the same way that you might think of Abraham. Now, it's from a Genesis 11 on then that the history of the Israelites itself begins. Instead, this block from Genesis 1 through 11 is a way in which the Hebrews answered some questions that every people answers in their stories, namely, what is the origin of things? How were things at the beginning? Where did things go wrong? How might things be yet set aright? Those are ancient tales of most every peoples, and these are collected from the traditions of the Hebrews to answer those kinds of questions. Now, since the topic today specifically focuses on the Noah account and peace issues, or issues of a nuclear world, I've gathered a few resources from the bookstore, and I want to share those with you at the outset. I put titles on the board. There are many books in the bookstore having to do with peacemaking and peacekeeping as Christian vocation, as part of the covenant with God. In fact, there's that one table in there that is exclusively peace issues, and then you'll find a whole section in addition to that on peace. So the items I have chosen from those are items which focus specifically on biblical materials and peacemaking. In that connection, I strongly recommend Dale Aukerman's book, Darkening Valley, A Biblical Perspective on Nuclear War. He opens with the Cain and Abel account and does interpretations of scripture on the whole question of violence and nonviolence, including then a discussion of the issues around nuclear weapons and the realities that they present in our time. So Dale Aukerman, Darkening Valley, is one of them. Another one, which is a collection of essays, is edited by Charles Lutz and Jerry Folk, both friends of Holden Village, and is entitled Peace Ways. And in this collection, rather wide-ranging, all the way from strategy issues on defense and disarmament to an understanding of biblical materials themselves, biblical paths to peacemaking, for example, as one of the chapters. In the midst of that are a number of essays which will intersect what we're going to be talking about. Thirdly, the very important pastoral letter of the American Roman Catholic bishops, entitled The Challenge of Peace, God's Promise, and Our Response. Unfortunately, I only have the second draft of that, and it is now published in its final form, still the same title, The Challenge of Peace. We do not have copies any longer in the bookstore, but you will find that, especially if you have a bookstore in your area that handles materials published by presses of the Roman Catholic Church, you'll find it rather easily available. It's getting very widespread attention, both within and without the Catholic Church. And the first part of the Catholic bishop's letter is a theology of peacemaking, which draws heavily upon biblical materials. So I strongly commend it. In fact, that Roman Catholic bishop's letter is worthy of your congregations or some group within it. It's careful study. It's the most significant piece done by church leadership on a major issue in a long time. Okay, then to the subject at hand. We're going to be looking at texts in Genesis, and at the end, one from Hosea. But before we move into that, I want to ask you why Noah and the Ark is usually regarded as a kid's story. I can't remember in church having serious study of Noah and the Ark in an adult forum or as a matter of Christian education for big folks. I do remember it seeing all manner of versions of it as a children's story. And the books that we have in the bookstore about Noah and the Ark are for kids. This is one of them. It happens to be my very favorite of all. But why is it associated as a kid's story? Why is it a children's story? Animals, surely. There seems to be some affinity of children for animals, some closeness there of affection and attachment, and it certainly is about animals. That immediately jumps to mind. The fantasy, it appeals to the abilities of the child to fantasize, appeals to children's imagination. It's an adventure, the storm, the near brush with death, the happy ending, and the rainbow. I mean, all of the qualities of adventure that belong to children's stories are there. We probably do a good bit of moral instruction in the process there. There are some lessons that the kids are supposed to learn there about obedience and reward. Yeah? And safety. Yeah. Graphic. Well, certainly. Yeah, that's I hadn't thought about that, but that characterizes a good children's story. It's very clear, very graphic, very dramatic. Yeah. Now, everything you said seems to me to be the makings of a good adult story. But why don't you associate this with... It's clear for the kids, it's not so clear for us. Yeah. Okay.
Maybe mental laziness to go deeper.
That may be it, too. I can tell you that at 8 o'clock at night, it's easier to read a kid's story than an adult story. Yeah. Huh? Yeah, we'll get into this. I don't think it's a kid's story at all. Yeah, there are many, many traditions and people that have the story of the Great Flood. When I was in East Africa for a little while, we lived near the Chaga peoples who live on the slopes of Kilimanjaro in the banana and coffee plantations. And the Chagas still tell stories. It's mostly an oral tradition rather than a written tradition. And they tell of the Great Flood. And their story of the great flood is that it came about because the rich oppressed the poor. And this was the God who lives atop Kilimanjaro, where earth and heaven meet, lives in a cave up there. This God caused the great flood to descend from the place where earth and heaven meet and to wipe out the rich. The poor were saved because they got the word of where they could go for shelter that the rich didn't know about. And the moral of the story is that if you oppress the poor, that the judgment, a similar in kind, may well await you. So the refuge for the poor was their equivalent of the ark. It was a safe haven while the flood descended. Yeah, and Aboriginal Australians also have still tell stories of the great flood. It is a common story. Okay, let's move into this. I want to contend from this little opening round here that the story is probably not a children's story, and it may be because we haven't looked at it carefully enough. Now, if this is a block from Genesis 1 to 11, then we've got to start a little bit before Noah, anyway. And let's go back to Cain and Abel, and note in chapter 4 of Genesis, verse 2, the following. And again she, Eve, bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. So we often associate then with Abel as a shepherd and Cain as a farmer. A tiller of the ground is very significant there. It is in keeping with the creation accounts, which belong to this same set. And in the creation accounts, the picture of the steward, the caretaker of creation, is one who, looking now at Genesis 2:15, and one who tills and keeps the garden. The Lord God took the man, Adam, and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. And in Jewish scholarship, you often associate that task of stewarding with the mandate to have dominion, that it is the human's human task to care for the creation, to be the tiller and the keeper of the garden so as to make its harmony sustainable for future generations and for one's own welfare. Well, Cain is the tiller of the ground. His task is to till and keep the garden. That relationship of Cain, now speaking about humanity and one of its roles, this figure who is all of us, or where we see something of ourselves, this archetype, if you will, that relationship of Cain to the ground is essential to the understanding of the story of Noah. Look at 4:8-16. It's familiar to you. And let someone just go ahead and read this. Chapter 4, verses 8 through 16.
Cain said to Abel his brother, "Let us go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel your brother?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me this day away from the ground, and from my face I shall be hidden. And I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will slay me." And the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who came upon him should kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Eden.
Thank you, Rudy. As your RSV probably indicates at the bottom of the page, after the word Nod, land of Nod, there's a italicized lowercase f. And in most Bibles, RSVs anyway, it will say in the bottom, wandering. So Cain is dwells in the land of wandering, which is east of home, east of Eden. Cain now is estranged from the land, from the earth. Cain is alienated from the ground. Cain's work as steward, as tiller, as keeper of Adama, of that from which Adam comes. In Hebrew, Adam comes from Adama, from the earth. This is earth creature. Cain, earth creature from Adama, is alienated from the earth. Cain is a fugitive and a wanderer. Cain is no longer at home. Cain is at odds from the ground and from his own task as tiller, as keeper. He says to Abel, his brother, let us go to the field. That is where Cain is at home. That is where Cain is to work. That is where, in his very place of being, this act, this primordial murder, takes place. What happens when Abel is killed? It is not, as you might expect, a discussion that follows about how one human being ought not to kill a member of one's own species, a fellow human being. It is instead, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, from Adama, from the stuff of which you are made, and we all are made. And now you are cursed from the ground. The discussion is not about Abel. The discussion is about the relationship of human beings, now pictured as Cain, to the earth. What has happened? As a consequence of a human act of killing violence, the planet, if you will, is cursed. The planet suffers the consequences, and we with it. We are no longer at home, and it no longer provides for us as it did. Take note. When you till the ground, that is your task as steward, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer. I'm reading from verse 12. It is Adama, it is the ground that no longer is properly related in God's harmonious creation to humanity. The killing of Abel is not only a violation of responsibility in the sense of it is the answer to the question, I am my brother's keeper, I am responsible for other human beings. The primary discussion here is that it is the ground itself, it is the rest of creation itself that suffers the consequences of human violence. Okay, now God is cast here in an interesting kind of role in this story. Cain has now violated creation. Cain is estranged, alienated from the ground. He is no longer at home in the world. Rather a wanderer, a fugitive, who must live in the land of wandering, which is east of home, east of harmony. And God says to Cain, who now fears for his life, that he, Yahweh, will restrain the one who seeks to take Cain's life. I want you to note two things here. One is Cain's immediate understanding that violence turns back upon itself. As soon as Cain has killed Abel, Cain fears for his own life. He knows in this act that he has unleashed something that threatens himself. So Cain is immediately afraid. Someone is going to slay me. Oh, there have been no slayings to this point. He doesn't know that from experience, that is, watching others slay others. He knows that from what he has done, that he, having unleashed killing violence, is subject to being a victim, just as he is made of his own brother a victim. So the fear sets in because he knows the consequences of violence, for he has been its perpetrator. Secondly, God is cast both in the role of someone who restrains violence. I will not let you, even though you have been the one to violate my creation, I will not let you be slain. God is the restrainer of this thing which now is unleashed in the world, namely human violence. At the same time, it's not full restraint. Vengeance shall be taken on the one who slays Cain sevenfold. It doesn't talk about killing violence. In fact, it says God put a mark on Cain, lest some who came upon him should kill him, as Cain fears. But there is talk about how violence then, even in its restraint, is restrained with the threat of other violence. Okay. Now what happens? There is in the block an escalation of human violence from this point onward. And you catch a glimpse of that even in the same chapter. In 4:23 and 24, Lamech, we're just a couple generations down the line here. You can move through a lot of generations in a short time in Genesis, but we're a few generations down the line. And Lamech says to his wives, Ada and Zillah, how'd you like to be one of Ada, Lamech's wives? You could be called Ada or Zillah. Have you ever known anyone named Ada or Zillah?
Ada.
Ada or Zillah. Yeah, Ada. Maybe Ada is also an archetype here. This is an original figure. Ada, let's change it to Ada here. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Hearken to what I say. I have slain a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold. Dale Aukerman says in passing, Lamech is the first proponent of massive retaliation. If someone threatens, is going to slay Cain, and God will use the threat of violence to restrain that one even unto sevenfold, Lamech is claiming already that if you think the threatening one to Cain caught it, you just try your hand at threatening me when I take the life of another. The revenge will be massive, the likes of which you have never seen yet, 77-fold. So there is a picture then of a kind of escalation of violence. Now, it is this same Lamech who is the father of none other than Noah. And if you look over at 5:28 and 29, you'll read the following. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he became the father of a son. and called his name Noah, saying, out of the ground which the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the toil of our hands. Do you see the connection to Cain? Out of the ground comes this one who is, in fact, this is a savior figure now. God is going to raise up a redeemer, one who is the agent of what God will do in addressing this violence-ridden creation. But even more than that, it is to bring us relief from our work and the toil of our hands. That is to say, people have been, are out of place. Creation is not harmonious. Work, stewardship to be tiller and keeper, has now become a burden. It's by the sweat of your brow that you will get what little the earth yields, now that it has lost its strength because of your acts of violence against others. Noah then is a savior figure, a redeemer, an agent of God, who himself, Noah, is called up from Adamah. Like Adam, he is of the stuff. This savior can only be one who comes from the same place, from the same stuff of which you come. This is not some god ascending from some other realm. This one who will bring relief must be incarnate, must know, what is the Spanish? Is Spanish for flesh? Yeah, carne, carne. Must be carnal, must come from flesh, must come from the ground. Lamech, who promises massive retaliation, is the father of the one whom now is to bring relief. I want to just make an aside about Hebrew understanding of creation. We can't take but a moment for that. Walter Brueggemann, in a book called Living Toward a Vision, Biblical Reflections on Shalom, says, the central vision of world history in the Bible is that all creation is one. Every creature in community with every other, living in harmony and security toward the joy and well-being of every other creature. All creation is interconnected. Creation is singular. Creation in the end, for all its diversity and richness, is one. And the picture of the primordial state of affairs is that all creatures live in community with all other creatures, not just human beings, but plants, animals, the whole planet together. In the preparatory volume for the United Nations Conference on the Environment held in Stockholm a few years ago, René Dubos, famous scientist, and Barbara Ward, Lady Jackson, famous development economist, wrote the following. There is something clarifying and irresistible in plain scientific fact. The astonishing thing about our deepened understanding of reality over the last 4 or 5 decades is the degree to which it confirms and reinforces so many of the older moral insights of humanity. The philosophers told us we were one, part of a greater unity that transcends our local drives and needs. They told us that all living things are held together in a most intricate web of interdependence. They told us that aggression and violence, blindly breaking down the delicate relationships of existence, could lead to destruction and death. These were, if you like, intuitions drawn in the main from the story of, from the study of human societies and behavior. What we now learn is that they are factual descriptions of the way in which our universe actually works. The way in which creation works is as a great complex interdependent reality, a single web of life. and aggression and violence breaks the web, and the results ramify through the web. That's the picture of creation that you have in Genesis, and thus the violence initiated by Cain then permeates the creation. So it is only of the stuff of all of life, the ground, Adama, that a redeemer, a savior figure, a agent of God's redemption can come. And this one is Noah. Okay, I don't think it sounds like a kid's story, does it? Well, maybe it is. Genesis. Genesis 6, 11 to 13. And I just do this to trace the given reason for the impending destruction. The reason that is given for the judgment that is about to come on creation is just recorded here. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them, meaning human beings. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Okay, the reason for the flood then is the corruption of creation through escalating human violence. Yeah, it is all flesh. It's all.
They
suffer the consequences of human violence. But all flesh is. It refers to all life. Yeah, all living things. In this block of materials, the movement is originally from chaos to creation. Was without form and void when God fashioned harmony out of the chaos. And then this harmonious order is disrupted through escalating human violence, and creation is nearly undone in its totality. It must be fashioned anew. And so in the Noah story, you have a retelling of certain mandates, certain tasks, certain elements of the creation story itself. Look at chapter 9, just the very first verse. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Does that sound familiar? That's from the original creation account. We're doing it over again. It's the block as a whole, 1 through 11, is creation, uncreation, recreation. And the picturing of this in mythic terms, in which the Hebrews thought, goes something like this. There are two ways in which Hebrews thought about uncreation, really about chaos out of which God creates. One is as darkness, and the other is as the watery abyss. If you think back to the first creation, it is light that begins, and God called the day light, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening and morning in the first day. Into darkness comes light, and the darkness is pushed back. But even before that, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. The picture of chaos is not simply nothingness. That's something you learned in Sunday school, that God created out of nothing. Rather, in Genesis, it's God's creating out of chaos. And the picture of chaos is darkness and the water. The Hebrew picture of chaos is the watery abyss. The silent deep. The picture of, you can imagine something whirling around, a massive water, drawing, if you imagine anything to exist at all, drawing all of it into itself. Our picture, I think, is the black hole. That's our equivalent of the watery abyss, where all things are drawn into something that is deep and dark, and where all that is heard is the awful silence of nothingness or of an eternal death. Now, what happens in the Noah account is that this same chaos of the watery abyss threatens to overwhelm all that God found in Genesis to be good. This same watery abyss threatens to undo the creation, and this same watery abyss is set loose by human violence. This is not a kid story, unless you think that judgment and destruction to within one hair's breadth of total chaos is kid stuff. This is not a kid story unless you think the wiping out of that which God made. Now, in the midst of this, nonetheless, a speck of life is preserved. And that's the story of Noah and the ark. In the midst of the return of creation, almost all of creation, to the primordial chaos, a little craft that holds a sliver of life is there. It's saved. And Noah and Frau Noah have the responsibility then for tending that. They are stewards. They have taken up, out of the ground they were raised, and they have taken up Cain's task to till it and to keep it, even though it's in a funny box here on the waters. There is a picture of the promise of God not to abandon creation totally despite human violence and creation's corruption. There is that promise kept alive in the midst of the near devastation of the world. There is a hope that's set vivid in the sky while judgment is visited upon this cascade of human violence. And that is the picture of the rainbow. What we've done with it is turn it into a decal for our windshield. Or we put it on our refrigerator doors. That's all right, but I just want you to see what levels of meaning and depth of meaning is here. The rainbow is the last sign of life when life itself hangs in the balance.
NBC TV.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And I think actually that it's very significant. I mean, I think that people do sense this is a sign of life when life is threatened. So I think there are layers there. But it's not frivolous and it's not superficial here. There are some peoples who have remembered that this story is primarily a story of judgment and destruction and not a children's story. Usually those peoples have been peoples who have been on the receiving end of human violence itself, who have been the victims of that rather than the wielders of it. And I am reminded of the black American spiritual, one line of which was used by James Baldwin, one of our best writers, to title a book. That spiritual goes, and God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more water, the fire next time. You hear it? Somebody knew that this was a story about judgment. And you best not continue the train of human violence, because next time, what the rainbow sign means is that the flood will not be a flood of water, but a flood of fire.
The colors in the rainbow even signify that, because some of the colors are blue. Red in the rainbow could be the one that's supposed to represent anger.
Or the darker colors, the purples and so on. Yeah, I never thought of that, that you have the whole imaging of creation, in a sense, in human reality there. So next time, yeah, Pierre.
Are you familiar at all with the auric sciences?
No.
Going from the lighter to the
dark. Yeah. I didn't know about the sciences, but that is the reality here. And that's what I want to... Well, let's move right into that. When we think of covenant, we usually think of a transaction between God and human beings, even a select group of human beings, a community of faith, a chosen people. And there are two biblical themes that run throughout scriptures. One of them is creation and the care of it. And the other one is the calling of a community of faith. The task of the community of faith, whether it's Israel among the nations or the church in the world, is to be witness to the hopes of God for creation. The community of faith stands in service of the primary biblical theme, which is all creation in the light of God. And I mean all creation. Our pictures of redeemed creation are creation in its totality. It's not anthropocentric, it's not humans only. Paul talks about all creation waits in travail and groaning until the redemption of human beings. I mean, if the problem was the corruption of creation by human violence, then the redemption of creation waits upon the redemption of those. But covenant is not simply between God and, say, Abraham and Sarah and their seed. That is one biblical covenant. Nor is it between God and David and his line. That's another biblical covenant. What is the what is the first biblical covenant? Take a look at Genesis 9 now. Verse 9 and following. Someone read from 9 all the way through 17. I mean, do we get the point? How many times in those verses is the point made? This is a covenant between me and the earth. This is a covenant between me and every living creature. We must remember that. I mean, the pansies have their covenant with God. The ground squirrels have their covenant with God. Not a separate one. It's all part of the same covenant. The deer have their covenant, and we with the deer. The folks who are larchomaniacs are up there to take special note of the covenant between the larches and God. The first covenant is the covenant between God and the earth. And now, just to connect with Pierre and Carol's point, and I hadn't done that before, the colors of the rainbow really represent the colors that are from earth colors to heaven colors, from that which is of the dust most completely to that which is of the light and all in between. And that's a good sign for such a covenant with the earth. The other image there is that you see an image of the rainbow which reaches from earth, arches through the heavens, and returns again to the earth, so that it is inclusive of that. I mean, the imagery is right for the point that is being made. This is also a covenant not simply for the present generation. This is the sign, verse 12, of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. The subject of this covenant is the life of future generations. This is a covenant between me and the earth. That's the space dimension of the covenant. This is the covenant between me and all future generations. That's the time dimension of the covenant. You can break this covenant in either of two ways. You can violate the space, that is, violence against the earth, or you can, in the process of doing that, also cut off life for future generations and violate the covenant by slicing a hole in the midst, right down the center of the life timeline of life, by cutting it in half.
It makes it pretty specific, though, that it's just water. Flood.
Yeah. Yes. Right.
So that's what narrows it down.
Well, the medium of destruction this time is water. That's right. It is the. But again, Rudy, that's the picture that the Hebrews have of chaos. I mean, that's their medium of talking about chaos. In Greek, the way of talking about ultimate destruction, or mass destruction, the word is holocaust. And it means the consumption by fire of all that is. But for the Hebrews, it is the water that consumes all and thereby destroys it. It's by drowning rather than burning. But it's a symbolism for... You're an artist, you understand that. It's a chosen symbol for that wider reality.
They don't consume or take away oxygen.
Interesting, yeah. And the word for spirit in Hebrew is the same word as breath. When the spirit moved upon the waters, it was the breath that moved upon the waters. That's what gives life. When Adam was created from Adama, this earth creature from the earth, he only became a living thing when it was given breath, spirit. Yeah. Now, I want to show you one thing in this kid's book that's different from every picture of Noah's Ark that I've ever seen. And it's the one place where it departs from the other children's book about Noah's Ark is precisely the place which is biblically most realistic or biblically accurate. The artist here is absolutely wonderful, and you have this collage of creation. I mean, every picture is just stuffed full of the stuff of life, you know. It goes on. I mean, you see feet and wings and parts of animals and so on. Noah's getting them all in there. Then it starts to rain. If you can see there, most of creation can't get in the ark and doesn't get in the ark. And it rains, and pretty soon the water is up to the butts of the elephants and the giraffes. And then it gets deeper. And you see the animals drowning. The next page, the water gets deeper and deeper, and you see cities below the surface of the water. Civilization is going under, so to speak. And then we return to the ark, but the picture of creation then is this single craft, you know, when all that is present is the watery abyss. Now, I've not seen other children's books that shows the animals drowning and human reality, human cities also being subjected to destruction. But that is the biblical story. And in the midst of that, there is a covenant made to save this raft of life as a promise to future generations. Okay. Our time is not long. I want to finish with two things. One, to draw a connection between that story and our time. Dan Erlander has this in a large chart, but I don't know where Dan's things are hidden, and he's in China. So I don't have this in a large chart. I only have it from the source that Dan took it from. This is what's called a map of megatons. It's a chart of the nuclear world, our world. It looks like those ceiling tiles that have all the acoustical dots in them. Only here, and there are 144, I think. 121, actually, of these tiles with all the dots. They all look alike except the one in the center. That tile has only one dot in it. That dot represents all of the explosive power of all of the weapons detonated in World War II, including the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So just imagine all of the firepower of World War II that was used. That's all totaled and represented by one dot. The one in the center. Now the kicker is that every dot in this chart represents that much firepower. Or I should say, the kicker is that those dots totaled represent the amount of destructive power that is present in nuclear weapons only in the world right now. It is the equivalent of 6,000 World War IIs that we're sitting on.
Right, that's in the research package.
In the whole, dams. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. It's from Christianity in Crisis, and they say right at the bottom of the page that this is not copyrighted and people can feel free to use it for peace education purposes. So this is we're sitting on top of the equivalent of 6,000 World War IIs. In World War II, 50 million people were killed, so that gives you some idea of the destructive power present today. The dots, there are in this picture, some of them circled, just a section of one tile. This one tile in the bottom right-hand corner has 9 dots circled on it. 9 World War IIs, okay? That is the firepower that is present in a Trident submarine. In one Trident submarine in the state of Washington. Now we're building a number of Trident submarines, but that's what's present in one of them. It's enough to destroy every major city in the Northern Hemisphere. We've got Trident submarines. The USSR has their equivalent of Trident submarines. You don't need 121 panels. You need one Trident submarine if you want 9 times World War II. Or you can take Poseidon, if you want a smaller version. Poseidon submarines, the United States has 31 of them, and they represent 9 megatons of firepower. Each of the 31 Poseidon submarines that the United States has carries 16 missiles equipped with 14 independently targetable warheads, which is enough to destroy all the major and all the medium-sized cities of the Soviet Union, and you can be sure the Soviet Union has its 31 Poseidon submarines to do the same to us. A dime placed on this chart would cover dots enough to representing enough nuclear weapons to destroy all major and medium-sized cities in the whole world. When the SALT I and SALT II treaties, the second one has not yet been signed by the United States, although both the Soviet Union and the U.S. have basically adhered to its provisions, even though it's unsigned. When the SALT I and SALT II treaties on limiting arms were negotiated, the bombs which were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that is, bombs of that size, were not included in the negotiations because they're too small. The bombs now are up to 1,000 times more destructive of the bombs that have been used. They simply belong to a different category of nuclear weapons. So I don't want to make this overly dramatic. I only want to point out something that Noah never dreamed of. Namely, that it's in the hands of human beings that power exists, in the hands of human beings, to threaten the triumph of chaos over creation. That you could have a flood of fire which would do what the flood of water did in the stories of many peoples of the earth. That it is in the hands of human beings now to violate the original covenant and do it from our side by way of the same means, namely the escalation of human violence that has consequences which corrupt the planet itself. And that it is in the hands of human beings to cut the time of the original covenant, namely that this is life for all future generations. This is the great new fact of the nuclear age. Never before have human beings had it in their hands to make possible the cessation of the possibility of future generations. That's what's different from World War II. In any past war, you have not extinguished the possibility of ongoing life, of future generations. The threat of nuclear holocaust is that you render the atmosphere such that future generations cannot live. I mean, not only of human beings, but I mean other forms of life itself. That the atmosphere no longer is conducive to the endless evolution of species of life. Okay, what did the Hebrews do when things got scary like that? What did Israel do when it didn't know what to do? Or when Israel found itself breaking one covenant or another covenant that it had made with God? On its better days, Israel gathered in worship. What it did was liturgy. And what worship did when it wasn't simply dull, when it was gripping, when it cut to the life issues that they were facing, what worship did was cut away some of the hopelessness and the helplessness they felt when they themselves realized the Cain in them and feared, like Cain feared, that that which Cain had unleashed might turn back on him, in this case them. What worship did was get rid of some of the fear, got rid of some of the hardness, got rid of some of the hate and the grief, What worship did when it was done right was celebrate the good things of life. A little bit like Lucille's Matins this morning, a celebration of the goodness of creation. It also got rid of some of the psychic numbing that too many of us know in a nuclear age and usually deny by not even talking about the destructive power around us. It revived folks and let them make responses to grave and present and great danger. But how did Israel do that in worship? It did it with stories and with images. It did it with art. It did it with images like the flood itself, which is a sense that all boundaries are awash and all life is in jeopardy. That's what the flood means. That's what our reality is. Boundaries don't mean anything in a nuclear age. All life is placed in jeopardy. Defending your borders doesn't mean anything when you have MX missiles or SS-19 or SS-20 missiles. There is no defense against that. All boundaries are awash, and all life is in jeopardy. The flood is an image which communicates that. Or an image like the ark, which maybe in our new covenant of our time needs to represent the planet itself. We ought to think of the planet itself as the ark of life. Or there is the dove and the olive branch, bearers of peace, carriers of the small signs of the renewal of life. Those are the tiny signs of life, fragile, a bird and a branch. This is a wonderful cover on this book. Do you see the missiles, the bombs? That's where it starts out to in red, talking about anger. And changing colors to light blue, and then it's a bird, a dove. It's a different version of swords into plowshares. This is missiles into doves here. So the dove and the olive branch, for us, the small signs of life, or the rainbow, as we mentioned, the carrier of all colors, the synthesis of the variations of creation, the bridge between heaven and earth, the product of sun and rain of creation. I think that's the makings of a new covenant, and I think that's what the story may be about. Now I'm just going to finish with a little bit of a story, two paragraphs, about two birds. Now this is a children's story. Finally we got to a children's story. About two birds, a coal mouse and a dove. Tell me the weight of a snowflake, the coal mouse asked the dove. Nothing more than nothing, was the reply. In that case, I must tell you a marvelous story, the coal mouse said. I sat on the branch of a fir, close to its trunk, when it began to snow, not heavily, not in a raging blizzard, no, just like in a dream, without any violence. Since I didn't have anything better to do, I counted the snowflakes settling on the twigs and needles of my branch. Their number was exactly 3,417,952. When the next snowflake dropped onto my branch, nothing more than nothing, you say, the branch broke off. Having said that, the coal mouse flew away. The dove, since Noah's time, an authority on the matter, thought about the story for a while and finally said to herself, perhaps there is only one person's voice lacking for peace to come about in the world. Thank you. Okay. Oh, I forgot Hosea. Yeah, excuse me. We gotta tack this on. I gave a wrong reference. It is Hosea 2:18.
Yeah.
Yeah, my apologies. 2:18. Let me just read that to you. This is appropriate to follow up Coal Mouse and the Dove. Hosea 2:18. And I will make for you a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land, and I will make you lie down in safety. The covenant is a covenant with the earth, with all of creation. But the covenant cannot be fulfilled until the bow is broken or the sword is broken, and there is war no more.